Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 12, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our topic is Cypre Awards in Class Action Litigation. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and we're recording the call for use as a podcast in the future. We're happy to have with us two experts today. We're going to hear opening remarks from each of them of some 8 to 10 minutes, then maybe a little bit of back and forth, and as always, we'll be looking for your questions at the end of our program, so please do be ready with your questions when we turn to the audience. We'll hear first today from Mr. Theodore H. Frank. He's the founder and president of the Center for Class Action Fairness, and he's an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute Center for Legal Policy. He will be followed by Professor Brian T. Fitzpatrick of Vanderbilt University Law School. The bios for each of our experts have, as always, been provided to you in the notice of today's call. They're available on our website, so I'll be very judicious with my introductions, and let's turn right to the discussion. With that, Mr. Frank, the floor is yours.
Thank you, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this call. Cypre is the process by which, or it is the name for, the class action settlement process where funds are distributed to third-party charities rather than to class members. The email for this phone call talked about residual class funds, and that's one common way of Cypre. You have a several million-dollar claim fund. The class does not claim all of the money in the fund. And what do you do with the leftover money? Often it goes to a third-party charity. But we also see settlements where the money is designated as Cypre to a charity without the class ever having an opportunity to claim the fund. And as I'm about to discuss, even when you do have a residual fund, often the settlement is structured in such a way that the parties anticipate that a large portion of the fund will eventually be residual and go to Cypre. The problems with Cypre are the inherent conflicts of interest it creates for a class counsel whose fiduciary duty are to the class members. If a settlement is structured so that money can go to the class or go to Cypre, and the attorney has no incentive or is indifferent between who receives them because he or she will get his fee based on the size of the fund, regardless of whether the class gets the money or Cypre gets the money, you might see attorneys prefer money to go to the third-party charities rather than to the class members. The third-party charities might be affiliated with the attorneys in some way. They might be a local charity, whereas the class is nationwide and diffuse. And besides, class members are generally not particularly grateful about getting an $8 check in the mail, whereas if you can hand over a $2 million giant paper-sized check to the local charity, they'll be very grateful and put your picture on their webpage. So you have that sort of inherent conflict of interest where if settlements are structured to permit money to go to third-party Cypre rather than to the class members, the class attorneys who are supposed to be working on behalf of the class members might prefer that the money go to the charity rather than to the class members, and thus might do might agree to processes that limit the extent to which class members can claim from the claim fund, or even just structure the settlement so that money goes to charity rather than to the class ab initio. So you have that sort of conflict of interest, even besides from the sort of conflicts of interest when the charities are affiliated with the attorney in some way. One Cypre success we had was shutting down a Cypre distribution where instead of giving money to the class, the money was going to go to a university that lead class counsel was affiliated with. Other possible conflicts of interest is that the Cypre may be something to create the illusion of relief, to make the settlement look larger than it is, to justify larger attorney's fees than might be possible if the settlement were fairly valued. Thus, a defendant may agree as part of a settlement to give money to charity, but it is a charity that they're already associated with, or it's a type of charitable donation that helps the company. In one famous case, Microsoft's Cypre, in a class action against Microsoft, their Cypre was that they would donate lots of Microsoft products to local schools, which made their competitor Apple very unhappy because that was cutting into Apple sales and would promote future Microsoft sales. In cases like that, the settlement isn't really actually adding any marginal benefit for the class. It's just a shift in accounting entries. Instead of Kellogg counting donations to a food bank that they would have given anyway, and they do to the tune of tens of millions of dollars, they agree to a settlement where they quote-unquote agree to give $3 million of food to a food bank, and they call that a settlement benefit, even though they're already giving food to a food bank, and there is no evidence that the settlement actually accomplished anything. The other potential conflict of interest is when judges get to direct where the Cypre money goes, and then you have the sort of unseemly process where charities are lobbying judges to essentially make legislative distributions of what is effectively a slush fund. In recent years, the law has started to recognize these problems, and there have been some interesting developments. Most notably, there is a case where my nonprofit brought a certiorari petition to the Supreme Court over a Facebook settlement where the attorneys got $2 million and then $6 million went to a brand new charity established by Facebook that would teach parents on how to help their children access the internet, something that was accused of actually promoting Facebook's interests rather than, say, a charitable interest. The settlement was approved by the district court and then by the Ninth Circuit over both a dissent and a dissent from rehearing en banc. The Supreme Court denied certiorari, holding that, but in an interesting and rare opinion by Chief Justice Roberts respecting denial of certiorari, he indicated that while this particular case was not the correct vehicle for resolving the issues, future cases should consider and might limit the application of Cypre on such issues of whether it's ever appropriate to distribute to Cypre when the class could be feasibly compensated, and who should be in charge of those distributions and what conflicts of interest are appropriate. The other major development came out of the Third Circuit. This is another Center for Class Action Fairness case, in a case called In Re Baby Products Antitrust Litigation. And this case had exactly the sorts of conflicts of interest I just discussed. Though there was a $35 million settlement fund, any residual money was to go to charity. And then the parties agreed to a process whereby it was essentially next to impossible for class members to ever get any money from the settlement fund. So the attorneys were going to get $14 million, the class members were going to get less than $3 million, and then the attorneys would get compensated a second time because they would have $17 million or so that they could choose to distribute to charity. The Third Circuit held that a district court should not consider money that's going to Cypre as equivalent to money that's going to the class because the class is not indifferent between the two, and that district courts should consider those factors when evaluating settlement approval. And sure enough, on remand, suddenly the parties discovered there were ways to get money to the class that they hadn't previously considered. The settlement has been restructured, and all that money that was going to go to Cypre is now actually going to go to the putatively injured class members. We have some interesting cases pending on the Cypre issue. One in the Eighth Circuit There was a securities case where the district court deliberately withheld $2 million out of the settlement fund and then demanded that or ordered that it be distributed to a local legal aid society rather than to the nationwide class. And a similar proceeding out in the Southern District of California on appeal to the Ninth Circuit, where the class got next to nothing and millions of dollars are instead going to go to local San Diego universities, again with a nationwide class affiliated with the class council. So we should see some interesting developments in Cypre law in the next year or two. I look forward to your questions and Brian's comments.
Professor Fitzpatrick, go right ahead.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you to the Federalist Society for organizing this call. I just want to say that what Ted and his organization do are extremely important, and I have the greatest regard for him and his organization. One of the big problems in class actions is that there's no one to air some of these grievances when these cases settle, because the class action lawyers and the defendants are all on the same side at settlement, and judges are not well trained to intervene in non-adversarial situations. And it's groups like TED that really bring a lot of these concerns to light, and I'm just very grateful for the role that he plays in making the class action system a better one. And this question of Cypre is one that I think Ted is absolutely right. We have seen a great deal of change in the law and in the practice over just the past couple of years. Courts are scrutinizing Cypre distributions like they've never been scrutinized before. And I think a lot of that is thanks to Ted. And it's very difficult now. I talk to a lot of class action lawyers, and it's very difficult for them to structure settlements because of the minefield that Cypre law has become. Where do I come down on many of these Cypre questions? I will say I don't disagree really with anything that Ted has said, that there can be some things that don't look very good when judges and lawyers start trying to use settlements for charitable donations. But I will stake out a different position in one regard, and that is I think that all of these complaints about Cypre distributions, I think all of the recent case law that's making them harder and harder to do, is really making a mountain out of a molehill. I follow a law and economics approach to the study of litigation, and I think that from that perspective, it's really hard to care very much about these concerning Cypre distributions. I just don't think it's worth a whole lot of time or energy at the end of the day. Why do I say that? Well, I say that because the class actions that we are talking about here, I think, are well described by what Ted said earlier, and that is, he said that class members are often not very grateful for the $8 check they receive in the mail, and I think he's quite right about that, and it's also important what he said there, because what we're talking about here are class actions where class members have a very small amount of money at stake. Their losses are small. The amount of money that they could get from the case is small. Why is that important? It's important because we are talking about a group of class action cases where the case is really all about deterrence. It's not about compensation. We are not going through all this trouble to get these $8 checks in people's hands. A lot of times people don't even bother to cash $8 checks. The compensation is not why we have the class action device. in these types of cases. We have the class action device for deterrence. We want to make sure the defendant pays for doing something wrong. We really, frankly, are less concerned about who the defendant pays. These things are about deterrence. So what does that mean? Well, that means that, you know, frankly, who gets the money at the end of the day is really less important than the fact that the defendant pays out the money. So, you know, if we can get the money in the hands of class members without too much trouble and expense and wasting of time, great. But if we can't get the money in the hands of class members without wasting a lot of time, energy, and money, then I see little problem with giving the money to charity. I see little problem giving the money to the government. I see even, this is not very popular, I know, but I even see little problem giving the extra money to the class action lawyers themselves. They were the ones that had to risk their own time and their own money by taking the case, and I see little downside to giving them more closer to optimal incentive to take these cases by giving them leftover money. I've written about that. But the point is, it's really not very important who gets this money at the end of the day. The more important question is the defendant paying out. So where does that leave us? Well, I think that leaves us, number one, I'm most concerned about the class of Cypre distributions that Ted described, where the distribution is really going back to benefit the defendant. That it's making the deterrent effect of the settlement look better than it really is because the defendant is really benefiting from the Cypre distribution. So I'm very concerned about those because those are, you know, cases where we're not getting as much deterrence as we might think we are. I'm less concerned, frankly, about the lawyers giving the money to charities that they're affiliated with or the judges giving the money to charities they're affiliated with. I agree it looks bad, but I'm not sure it really is undermining our system of justice in any significant way. As long as the companies are paying for the harm they're causing, then we're getting deterrence, and we ought to be happy with that. What I don't want is a world where we create so many nuanced rules about when you can have Cypre distributions and when you can't, that we end up wasting a lot of time creating a lot of hurdles to class action litigation that only at the end of the day end up benefiting defendants. If it becomes too difficult to bring one of these cases and get it settled and get it finalized, lawyers are going to be less inclined to bring these cases. I don't want to create a lot of potholes and minefields that a profit-motivated class action objectors can use just to hold up these settlements and to get side payments for themselves and basically extract a tax on class action litigation, which again will discourage class action litigation. And I'm afraid that if we go too far down this path that Ted is taking us, we're going to end up with a lot of nuanced rules. I mean, now courts are requiring second distributions to class members. So we have the initial distribution, there's money left over, rather than just giving it to charity, now courts are saying you got to send out checks again to class members. Why not a third distribution? I mean, I think we're just spending a lot of time, energy, and money giving people arguments on why these settlements should not be approved, placing weapons in the hands of profit-motivated objectors to hold things up for their own gain. And all this is taxing the ability to bring these lawsuits, which in the end is only undermining deterrence because it's helping defendants, because lawyers aren't going to be as willing to bring these cases anymore if they're so hard to settle. And so I think while much of what Ted says has a lot of merit to it, I think that it's just a misfocused energy. It's misfocused energy because I don't think it's that important. As long as the defendant is paying out, that's what we should keep our eye on. And some of this stuff I think is going to distract us from that rather than help us with that. Thank you.
Well, thank you both. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button. Yeah, after that, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, and we'll get to your questions as soon as we have some back and forth between our panelists here.
Uh,
So now, Ted Frank, if you would go ahead with your response, we'll begin to queue up the questions while you're speaking.
Thanks. Just a couple of responses. One, Brian posits a world where the class action is a substantive device. It's attorneys as bounty hunters seeking out corporate wrongs and punishing defendants as private attorney generals on behalf of the public. And certainly there are people who take that position, including Brian and many academics and a number of lower court judges. But that's not what the class action device is. It's a procedural device, and the clients do come first. We do have a Rule 23A4 class representative requirement. It's not that a lawyer brings a suit, ex rel the public. He brings it on behalf of a client who is supposed to be representing absent class members. And in terms of the positive role in this debate, is the class action a substantive device or a procedural device? This isn't controversial at the Supreme Court level. It's a 9-0 kind of thing that class members count, and you can't let the procedural tail wag the substantive dog. So with that in mind, is it so terrible that class members come first when you're structuring a settlement? And in just the short year since baby products, we have learned very empirically that this was a much bigger problem than anybody even reasonably anticipated, because in response to baby products, which says you have to try to get the money to the class members first, suddenly all these class action attorneys who have always said, oh, we've structured the settlement way because there's just no way to pay the class members, and so we had to give the money to our favorite charity so that we could get the deterrence we wanted, have suddenly learned that, yes, they can get money to class members. So a Bayer settlement that we objected to, where there were only 50,000 claims or so, suddenly the attorneys discovered a way that they could get $5 million to other class members by actually mailing class members checks instead of forcing them to jump through a claims process that they knew nobody was going to adopt and that the money could go to their favorite charities. In baby products, a $15 million slush fund disappeared because, again, they found a list of class members that they could actually mail checks to. And we're seeing several other settlements that are structured ab initio so that the money goes to the class rather than to the charities. And even in terms of Brian's goal of deterrence, what we're seeing is these Cypre settlements, especially the ones that were all Cypre up front, these were cases brought against defendants who were doing something wrong. These were cases brought against defendants with deep pockets, and they were being settled for nuisance amounts. But if there was a nuisance amount that was fairly distributed to the class, the attorneys would lose money. So they had to structure the settlement to create the illusion of relief so that the attorneys could get all the money. And the way you did that was through a Cypre, where the defendant gave the money to its own charity and then gave a commission to the attorneys to go away and for waiving all the class's claims. And that's what happened in Facebook, where it was supposedly a multi-billion dollar case that settled for essentially $2 million in attorney's fees. And in terms of deterrence, if you want deterrence, you want deterrence for companies that have actually done something wrong, where the class members have actually been injured and should be compensated. You don't want deterrence just for being a deep pocket. That's the opposite of a deterrence, because then a corporation doesn't have any incentive to be good or bad, because the good and the bad get lumped into the class action defendant settlement situation. And if these bad settlements, if the nuisance settlements suddenly become unprofitable, if it suddenly becomes unprofitable to bring a meritless class action where the attorneys can profit because they get 100% of the settlement proceeds, I think that's a feature rather than a bug.
Professor Fitzpatrick, you want to take a minute before we turn to our audience?
Sure. I'll just respond to each of those three points in reverse order. So we're all against, you know, frivolous litigation, whether it's individual or class action litigation. We're all against frivolous litigation. I guess the question is whether the presence of a Cypre distribution is a good proxy for whether litigation is frivolous. I don't think it is. I think it's a good proxy for litigation being small stakes. And I think it is important to hold defendants accountable, even when they cause small harms, because small harms add up over the course of one's life and one's day. And we don't want to give companies incentives to take small amounts of money from people because they know they can get away with it. There's other ways to deal with frivolous litigation. I've written about that. I support lots of tort reform measures to get rid of or make it harder to bring frivolous litigation. Can we get the money to the class members if we really try? Absolutely we can. I mean, if we want to waste a lot of time, energy, and money, we can do it. We can do double, triple, quadruple distributions, keep, you know, sending more and more checks out pro rata every time a few dollars is left over in the account. I talked to one class action lawyer not too long ago. He said, no one is more responsible for keeping the post office in business than class action lawyers. They're sending postcard after check after check. It's certainly keeping the post office afloat, and so if that's another one of our goals, then we can continue to do that. I'll close by addressing what I think was Ted's most important point here in response, and that is this question of whether we want class actions to be serving the goal of deterrence or not. Ted intimates that we can't have that goal because that's a substantive goal and class actions are only supposed to be doing procedural stuff. I think that's just a philosophical difference between the two of us. Like I said, I take the law and economics approach here. And I don't see wasting a lot of time jumping through a lot of hoops for people that have been injured $5, something that increases social utility. And I'd like to hear the case for the procedural account. Is there a policy case to be made for ignoring the deterrence aspects and focusing on compensation to people who really don't care to cash the checks? Is there really a policy case for that particular conception of the class action? I don't think so. At least from a law and economics perspective, I don't think there is. And so for those reasons, I do endorse the private attorney general model. This is one way to regulate in society. It's a privatized regulation model. It's like, you know, privatizing a government function. We conservatives support it in lots of other areas, and I'm not afraid of supporting it here in this area as well. Thank you.
All right, let's turn to the audience. We've got a couple questions pending. Push the star button and the pound button on your phone if you would like to be added to the queue. Before we do that, let me make a quick announcement about tomorrow's call. We have a telephone call scheduled tomorrow at 2 p.m. when we'll be talking about Dodd-Frank and FSOC. That's 2 p.m. Eastern time. With Peter Wallison, and I think we're adding Wayne Abernathy to that call as well. But do check the Federalist Society website and our Teleforum page for additions to the calendar. With that, let's go to our first caller today. Go ahead,
hey,
caller. You might have your... Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. I've got a quick question about the procedure for challenging a Cypre award. It seems like in a lot of class actions, to object to the Cypre award or I guess any part of the settlement agreement, you have to opt into the class. Or it sort of seems counterintuitive. If you're a class member that thinks that the class is a bad deal, you would opt out. But if you opt out, then you basically disqualify yourself from challenging it. How often do you guys see that? And do you think that sort of process that's been set up by judges sort of has a chilling effect on challenges to these Cypre awards and allows them to be certified in situations where they might not otherwise be certified if people could actually file challenges?
Well, certainly, as long as we're talking about incentives, I think the incentive to be an objector to a class action. There were clearly a shortage of such incentives, as demonstrated by the fact that there was room for my nonprofit to come in and win all these cases that hadn't been won in the 20 years before we came in, and change where these things were going on the CyPRE, because nobody was challenging them, and they were just getting rubber stamped, and they were getting increasingly abusive. It's not so much that you need to opt in. Your default is you are in unless you affirmatively opt out, and there's actually no point in opting out in the typical consumer class action. Nobody cares if you opt out. Unless a million people opt out and can bring their own separate class action, the fact is that these claims are so small they're going to get brought as a class action or they're not going to get brought at all. It might be different. About the only time an opt-out might make a difference is in the securities context, if you're a especially large shareholder who can negotiate your own settlement. The problem is more that it's expensive to bring an objection. It requires time and money, and bringing a successful objection does not get you paid. The reason we see the sorts of objectors Brian complains about who come in and threaten to hold up the case and get paid to go away is because those people are making a lot more money than I'm making. The system is structured so that you get paid more for bringing a losing objection than for bringing a winning objection. To the extent Brian supports bounty hunters, I hope he comes in and supports rules that give incentive to object to bad settlements that reward the attorneys over the class. We won $15 million for the class in baby products, and it'll be interesting to see whether we can even get a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of that, or whether, we had the same result in a recent Facebook settlement. We won several million dollars for the class, and the judge refused to award us fees. Just a token amount of fees. That's absolutely a problem, that class members don't have the right incentives to object to these abusive CyPRE awards. The solution is to object rather than to opt out, and opting out takes time and money too and doesn't really accomplish very much. So perhaps if you are aggrieved by a bad CyPRE award, I have a nonprofit that might be willing to represent you.
I agree with
Professor Fitzpatrick. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree with everything Ted said there. Just to be precise, to the answer to the question, I've never seen a settlement where you could both opt out and object at the same time. So you either have to do one or the other. And I have fought long and hard against the profit-motivated objectors that are just trying to hold things up. I shouldn't say profit-motivated because that's maybe not the right word, but they're just hold-up artists. They bring meritless claims and try to enter into side deals for themselves. And I think we do need more good-faith objectors like Ted, and I would support rules that allow the good-faith objectors to get compensated. I would do it on the same kind of terms we compensate the class action lawyers. I think that the objectors ought to get a percentage of what they improve the settlement by. So if they're going to increase the deterrent value of the settlement by a certain amount through their objections, I think they ought to get a percentage of that. Maybe you throw the Lodestar cross-check in too, because it doesn't take too much time to do an objection compared to litigating a whole case, of course. But some significant compensation to give people good incentives to bring good faith objection instead of just trying to hold things up all the time, I think is the right way to go. And Ted, I hope you do get some of that money of your organization.
We're speaking today about Cypre. We have one caller question pending. If you'd like to join the list of questioners, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Hello. I was just calling to inquire about the specific points of where the finances are directed, even if we take the approach of viewing class action lawsuits as purely a substantive matter. Why is it not preferable to have some kind of means for directing whatever Cypre funds there are in a case toward some kind of charity directed toward remedying the kind of issue at hand, rather than just being subject to some kind of embezzlement by the attorneys or disseminated to somebody's pet charity?
I think it's a question directed towards me, and I think we ought to do that. I mean, to the extent we feel compelled to give this money to a charity, I think, sure. Let's pick the charity that is kind of most closely connected to remedying the underlying harm. All I am suggesting here is that while we should try to do that, I'm not sure that we should kill ourselves in trying to do that, because I'm really not sure how important that is in the grand scheme of things. And what I'm afraid is happening here is that we have a whole bunch of nuanced rules that are beginning to get laid down by these courts that just create a bunch of minefields and potholes, and then just empower hold-up artists to complain endlessly about these settlements, and it just ends up being a big tax on class action litigation. And at the end of the day, the only people who benefit from that are the hold-up artists and the defendants, because there's going to be less of these suits being brought. And so I'm fine. I just don't think that we should get too exercised about it and put too many procedural hurdles in the way of settling these cases and moving on with our lives. And I'm just afraid that's where we're headed now.
Ted Frank, you want to weigh in here?
For what it's worth, I'd prefer bright line rules to the sort of eight-factor balancing test, too. If you create legal certainty, people know what to do in advance, and then when they don't do it, you are going to get objections. But you get the problem when you do create the sort of nuanced rules. Well, it may be okay in some situations, but not in others. Then you're asking for that sort of conflict. We've always asked for the bright line rule, and we haven't always gotten that from the courts.
Ted, what is your bright line rule? No Cypre, period?
We've just asked to go with the American Law Institute section 3.07 of their Principles of Law of Aggregate Litigation. You don't give money to Cypre if it's feasible to give money to the class. The parties should pick a single charity that has no affiliation with either the plaintiffs or the defendants that is reasonably related to the class's interests, which is, I think, a slightly different formulation than the Dennis v. Kellogg case, which had a problem with food banks. We objected to a different Kellogg case, and we didn't have a problem with the food banks other than the fact that it wasn't actually anything other than a change in accounting entries for Kellogg. But the idea that it has to go to a specific consumer fraud organization, I think, is equally problematic. In many cases, the class doesn't want that. I saw CyPray recently where they wanted to give it to the Center for Science in the Public Interest, I think is the name of the public interest law firm, quote-unquote public interest there, because they're the ones who bring litigation. McDonald's is committing consumer fraud because they sell high-fat food kind of litigation that 95% of the American public in polls says that's the sort of litigation that shouldn't be brought at all. And that's not clear that that's a class benefit when they that sort of CyPray happens. But all too often we you know, the CyPray is never going to go to the Federalist Society or to the Institute for Justice or to the Center for Individual Rights. It's always going to go to a trial lawyer friendly left-wing organization when that happens.
We need to get some of our Federalist Society members to become class action lawyers then.
Well, Professor Fitzpatrick, by the way, if you have a question in the audience, from the audience, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We have some more time. We're happy to take your questions. I wonder, Professor Fitzpatrick, if you want to react to Ted Frank's bright line rule. Does that seem objectionable to you, or are you fine with his bright line rule?
Well, I have to be honest. It didn't seem very bright to me. I think there was the word feasible in there and the word reasonable in there, and that just gives folks so much room to complain in every case that something was feasible or something wasn't reasonable. And so I do like much of what the ALI did in their restatement of principles, but I'm not sure that's a very bright line. And as long as we have these hold-up artists, I'm not sure it's going to be very helpful with that line.
I mean, I've talked to hold-up artists, and you know, it doesn't really matter whether they have a good case. Their cases are often based on the 2 years of delay that are imposed by an appellate court. But and I've talked to other people who are characterized as hold-up artists, and they want to bring good objections. I mean, there's a wide, even among the holdup artists, there's a wide spectrum of people, and some of them, you know, really want to do the right thing, and they're settling some cases so that they can afford to bring the occasional case to actual appeal, you know, given the unfortunate reality we have now where losing objectors get paid more than winning objectors, not everybody can start up a 501c3 and get donations to sort of fund themselves paying themselves a fraction of market rate. Not everybody wants to do that. But one bright line rule we could adopt, which I think would align the incentives to avoid the conflicts of interest, is you pay the class action attorneys more when they win money for the class than when they win money for the charity. That's already encoded into the Class Action Fairness Act at Section 1712E in the case of coupons. And if you did that up front, you get 25% of what you win for the class and 10% of what you win for the charity. Suddenly, you would find the class action attorneys looking for ways to make sure that the class recovery was maximized rather than the charitable recovery was maximized. And it's the latter problem. Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say to Professor Fitzpatrick, what's wrong with a rule like that that sort of changes the incentives from the plaintiff's attorney's perspective on the front end in the law and economic sense?
Yeah, no, it sounds good, but I'm uneasy about it. I'm uneasy about it because I think that there are a lot of cases when you're not going to be able to get very much money in the hands of the class members because you don't know who the class members are. You know, some of these consumer cases, it's very hard to get the names and the addresses of who the class members are. And so it's going to be very hard to get money to these people, and there's going to be money left over. And if the lawyer is only going to get a small percentage of that, even though the deterrence effect is the same. Whoever gets this money doesn't affect the fact the defendant is paying it out. So the deterrence effect is the same, but the class action lawyers are going to get paid less in this class of cases where they know there's going to be Cypre because it's hard to notify and identify the class. You're just going to discourage the lawyers from taking those cases. And I just think that's bad in the long run for deterrence because, you know, some people take the view that if the loss is small, there shouldn't be any litigation over it at all. That's a waste of society's time to try to do something about small harms. I don't share that view. I think we ought to hold defendants accountable even for stealing $100 from millions of people in the same way we'd hold them accountable for stealing, you know, $10 million from one person. I think it's, you know, a lot of small wrongdoing adds up over the course of people's lives. And we're going to end up disincentivizing lawyers to take these small harm cases if we adopt that kind of rule. So it leaves me uneasy, although I do agree, if you're really worried about these conflict of interest and which charity gets it, it would have the effect of mitigating some of that concern. I'm just not really worried about that. I'm more worried about incentivizing the lawyers to hold defendants accountable.
We do have another question from our audience. Ted Frank, did you have something further there?
No, let's get the question.
Okay, and again, if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Ted and Professor Fitzpatrick, thanks for your time today. This has been very interesting. We've seen in our state some laws pointed at trying to turn Cypre settlement funds into possibly funds that escheat to the state. And I'm surprised, given how cash-strapped states are, that we haven't seen more of this yet. So I have a two-part question. One, are there due process concerns with attempts to do that? The claim being that if you are a class member whose rights are being forfeited for the state's benefit, even if it would be inefficient to pay your claim, perhaps you don't want it going to the state. And two, if there aren't due process concerns, if this is an option, would that mitigate some of the conflict of interest problems with the current Cypre structure?
I don't think there's a due process problem with escheat. In fact, I think a lot of escheat laws on the books affirmatively apply to what's happening in the Cypre context. You have a leftover fund that's unclaimed. And the state of Texas has actually successfully argued in at least one case that by law that goes to the state of Texas with respect to Texas class members. And we've suggested at least in the federal context that there, and I apologize that I don't remember the statute off the top of my head, I think it's 2412. But there's a federal escheat statute that says it goes to the U.S. Treasury, and we've suggested that that's the appropriate result in some Cypre cases. So I would agree that that would mitigate things. And in terms of the separation of powers problem, when it's judges deciding whether the charity is appropriate, if the legislature steps in and designates a charity, that would solve at least that aspect of the problem, though it might introduce other problems.
Yeah, I think I agree with Ted here that unless the lawsuit was a class action against the state, there probably wouldn't be a due process concern or even much of a concern. Obviously, if the lawsuit is against the state, we don't want the money going back to the state because it undermines some of the deterrence that we're trying to achieve. And, you know, as I, you know, said before, I'm happy to give it to the government. I'm happy to give it to the charity. I'm happy to give it to the class. I'm happy to give it to the class action lawyers, the extra money, to give them good incentives to bring these cases. I think we can do lots of things with it because, again, the most important thing is what the defendant is paying, not who gets it. And so this is a viable option. Some scholars advocate this instead of charities and what have you. And so it's certainly very, very viable in my view.
We've got two more questions pending now, about 10 minutes, so let's take another question.
Hi, this is Gail Harriet. The part about this that concerns me the most is this notion of judges being lobbied on this issue. And one of the things that's always bothered me about a law and economics analysis here is it sometimes neglects to use law and economics against the judicial system as well. You know, we wouldn't think of allowing judges to handle small-time criminal cases if they were going to benefit in some way from the fine. Can we at least have, you know, that as a hardline rule, that if a judge is involved in selecting the charity, then that's got to be off the table. And another thing that concerned me is that the discussion here, we kept mentioning litigation oriented vehicles as the charity. Lawyers tend to think of fellow lawyers as a good person to give money to. And that strikes me as the opposite of the kind of charity we should be looking at, because that sets out red flags of is that charity being chosen simply because it has some relationship to the lawyers? Could that be another possible bright line rule? No awards to organizations whose purpose it is to create litigation.
Gail, I completely agree with you on both aspects. Our first CyPRAE appeal involved a judge approving she didn't select the charity, it was selected by the parties, but one of the charitable recipients was a charity her husband sat on the board of, which was also a local legal aid society.
Even beyond that, just anything that creates litigation is loved by lawyers.
I completely agree that there's there tends to be a bias to make it a legal charity, and we have complained about that. And unfortunately, in the Dennis v. Kellogg case, the rule the Ninth Circuit adopted there encouraged that bias, saying, well, this is a consumer fraud case, and therefore the nexus needs to be towards consumer fraud organizations.
Yeah, should be the opposite.
But if you were to poll consumers, I think they would pick a different charity. But I've seen some really there was one case in the Northern District of California, and the parties proposed a range of charities, many of which were affiliated with the defendants, and a different charity came in and objected and said, we think we should get some of the money, and the judge says, okay, you can stop your objection, I'm throwing you $250,000, and sua sponte, I'm awarding $250,000 to a local university where I happen to be teaching as an adjunct. And to me, that was just outrageous. And if he hadn't immediately retired thereafter, I would have filed a disciplinary complaint. But I think it's a very much an under-reported issue.
Gail, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. There's just such a lack of transparency where the money is going in these cases that, in the Third Circuit ruled that the class didn't even need to get notice of who the recipients were going to be. We just don't know how big the problem is. And I agree with Brian that out of the top 100 problems in the world, this isn't one of them. But I think it is a problem. There is rent seeking going on. There are conflicts of interest that we shouldn't encourage in the legal system going on. And we don't know the scope of it, other than what we've seen in the last year post baby products suggested that it was a much bigger problem than anybody envisioned.
I would just add to that, Gail, I like how you framed the issue vis-a-vis the judge. It's not just an optics problem. It doesn't just look bad, but you're right, actually, that there is a due process concern with having a judge that has some kind of financial incentive to rule one way or another in the case. I think you could make the argument that if the judge really wants to give a bunch of money to his favorite charity, he's going to be more inclined to approve the settlement so he can have access to that money. And I think you make a good point that should concern us, maybe apart from just the optics, and maybe the judge is not going to do his job in scrutinizing the settlement because he's eager to get the money to give to his charity. And so I think you make a very fair point. You know, it's interesting, a lot of times when the lawyers, I mean, it is quite possible, obviously, to find charities that are related, on your second point, related to litigation, even though they're not litigation charities. And so, for example, some of the cases I've been involved in that have been consumer fraud cases, the charities were consumer literacy groups as opposed to consumer litigation groups. So it was helping consumers become more literate about financial products and what have you. And I thought that was a very worthwhile thing to do. Sometimes, though, when the judges look for charities that are not litigation related, they get into trouble. There was a very famous case that was talked about in the New York Times where a district court judge, it was an antitrust case brought by a bunch of models against the modeling agencies in New York City, and the case settled, and there was a CyPRE, and the judge decided that the charity that the models would most like the extra money to go to would be an eating disorder charity, and he got into a lot of trouble. So sometimes you can get into trouble if you try to go too far away from litigation, but I think both your points are well taken.
Let's spend our last few minutes.
And not just just to add one thing, it's not just that the judge will be more inclined to approve the settlement, but the chamber has expressed concern that the judge will be inclined to make rulings that will create a big settlement fund in the first place.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's take a final question here.
If deterrence is the primary concern, then the administrative costs of sending many small payments to many class members would not be an obstacle to serving that deterrence interest. But if the secondary concern is redressing the small harms suffered by these many individuals, then shouldn't going through the motions, the rigmarole of dispersing that money to all the class members, those little checks, would still be a higher priority than the CyPRE?
Ryan, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think, again, if the defendant's paying for it and if the money to go through the rigmarole is just coming out of the amount the defendant's paying, we are achieving the same amount of deterrence. And, again, I have no problem going through the rigmarole. That's, you know, fine if we want to go through the rigmarole. All I'm saying is that going through the rigmarole could end up slowing things down and delaying things so much that we end up making it not worthwhile to bring some of these cases. So let me give you an example. Let's say we go through the rigmarole and send out all the checks. You got to give people a couple of months to cash their checks. A big percentage of the class is not going to cash their check, so there's going to be money left over in the account. So what do we do now? Well, thanks to Ted and his friends, now the courts are saying, send all the checks out again to the people that cashed them the first time. Divide up the money and send out more checks. And so now the courts are doing that. Well, what's going to happen? Well, some of those people who, even though they cashed a check the first time, they aren't going to cash it the second time because the check is smaller now. So got some more money left over in the account. And so we can keep doing this, but it's really kind of silly at some point. These checks are so small, it's really quite silly, and we're just going to end up slowing things down, delaying things, and giving people more stuff to complain about. You only did it twice, not three times. You didn't send it to everybody the second time, only the people who cashed the first time. All these complaints end up giving ammunition to people who want to tax the system. And so we have to ask ourselves, yes, wouldn't it be wonderful if every class member could get their check, but is it worth it? Or should we just make the defendant pay and move on? And I tend to be in the latter camp.
Final word from Ted Franken, and I think we're going to have to call it a day.
Sure. I think it'll be interesting. You know, a part of that is just the way we do banking in 2014, which in many ways is different than the way we banked 20 years ago. And some of this will be solved technologically 20 years from now when micropayments will be efficient, you know, 23 cents will appear in your Amazon accounts or your Facebook accounts or your Microsoft accounts or what have you, and or will all be paid in bitcoins, who knows. But I don't think anybody here is advocating for spending $1 million to distribute $78.37 left over in the settlement fund. You know, if you're talking really small amounts that would cost more to distribute than to actually pay to the class, it's not unreasonable to let that escape to the state or to a reasonable charity. Or I saw an interesting law review article, lottery it out. Give it to a random class member. You serve the deterrent effect and you've given class members an incentive to participate in the claims process. There are lots of options out there, but we're not. I don't think we've ever taken a completely unreasonable position on this issue.
Well, this is Dean Reuter. Once again, I want to thank Professor Brian Fitzpatrick and Ted Frank. We certainly appreciate your thoughts today. This is a fascinating discussion. I think we'll probably revisit it sometime in the not-too-distant future. To the audience, thank you for joining us as well, and thank you for your questions. And a reminder to join us for our next Teleform conference call tomorrow at 2 p.m. We'll be discussing FSOC and Dodd-Frank. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.